Until Harvard is able to fully reckon with that problem and align its investments with the values of its institution, you know, the motto of Harvard is Veritas, truth. And it's really astounding that at a university which sort of seeks to train the next generation of leaders, we aren't thinking critically about the impacts of where the money of Harvard's endowment is going and how that is actually impacting the future.
Talia Rothstein, we want to thank you for being with us, sophomore at Harvard, one of the coordinators of Divest Harvard, and Professor Naomi Oreskes, who teaches history of science, affiliate professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Harvard University. Her books include The Collapse of Western Civilization and Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. That does it for our show. We have a job opening. Social media producer, go to our website at democracynow.org. And next Thursday, April 23rd at 7 p.m., I'll be speaking at Colorado College in Colorado Springs. Go to our website for more information. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltzer, Amatli, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Malkoff, Hani Massoud, Rabbi Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland. 90.7 FM Portland.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
One, two, ready, go!
Tune in to KBOO Monday, April 27th through Friday, May 2nd from noon to 4. And Saturday and Sunday, May 2nd and 3rd from noon to 5 p.m. to hear our live broadcast from the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, brought to you by our friends and colleagues at WWOZ in New Orleans. We'll have access to five stages of fantastic traditional and contemporary New Orleans jazz and blues, brass bands, and interviews and commentary by the best that WWOZ has to offer. That's the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival starting Monday, April 27th. The weekdays, we'll broadcast it from noon to 4 p.m., and Saturday and Sunday, May 2nd and 3rd, we'll broadcast the festival from noon to 5 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portlanders gather to demonstrate against the Nestle Corporation's plan to bottle water from the Columbia Gorge.
Fast Track Trade Authority is introduced in the U.S. Congress to allow the president to push forward with a controversial Pacific Trade Agreement.
And an army colonel in Chile has been charged with the murder of political folk singer Victor Jara, 35 years after Jara's death.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 16th, 2015. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Sarika Mehta. A bill to amend the Oregon Constitution to allow limits on campaign contributions will go before a Senate committee next Tuesday. The bill, SJR 5, is being promoted by Governor Kate Brown as a way to address the out-of-control spending of candidates by special interests. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Jeff Lang, who is active on the issue of campaign finance reform in Oregon.
Can you tell us a little bit about the bill? I understand it creates a constitutional amendment.
Yeah, it's SJR 5. It was originally written by Governor Kate Brown when she was Secretary of State about 6-7 months ago. And basically an attempt to put a $2,500 cap on all state offices in Oregon for campaign contributions.
And what's the cap right now?
The Oregon Constitution does not allow for cap on individual candidates. So the process, once we get through the legislature, then we need to take it to the voters to change the Oregon Constitution. It's a long process. And that would be in November 2016.
So this bill is in committee. It has a hearing on April 21st. What's the status of it? How many co-sponsors is it likely to pass?
Presently, we've got about 11 co-sponsors. I'm extremely optimistic, as is the rest of the folks in our coalition. It's like everything else in the political world. It has its challenges, but I think it is likely to pass because it's the right thing to do. We were down in Salem starting in January, myself, Tom Bowerman from Eugene, and a couple of staffers from Common Cause Oregon. We met with 31 legislators. Most of the legislators basically said they're just so sick and tired of raising money to run for office in Oregon. That they were supportive, but most of them at the end of the day, other than the sponsors, said the devil's in the details and that they were going to look very closely at this legislation plus the three other bills that have been introduced in the legislature, which are part of our campaign finance reform program.
What got you involved in the issue of campaign finance reform as a business owner here in the state of Oregon?
Myself and my family had been donors to progressive causes and candidates over many years, and we thought we were doing the right thing and contributing as citizens. But as time went on in the, I would say the mid-2000s, we realized that all we were doing was feeding a broke, corrupt system where bribery and access to power.
Well, and we will continue to keep an eye on this SJR5 campaign finance reform bill here in the state of Oregon. Has a hearing this coming Tuesday, April 21st, in the Senate Committee on Rules. We've been speaking with Jeff Lang, who is involved in the campaign to get this and other bills passed in the Oregon legislature this term. This is Jenka Soderberg reporting for KBOO News.
Oregon House Speaker Tina Kotek introduced a bill that would limit the amount of money Washington County receives from the state's controversial gain share program. Under the current program, local governments provide big property tax cuts for companies that invest in their areas, such as Intel. Then, when new workers are hired for those companies and pay income taxes, gain share taxes a large part of that money and returns it to the county or city. Speaker Kotek argues that the tax money would be better spent on public services across the entire state. The bill would cap the amount of money that Washington County gets at $10 million, a huge decrease from the $94 million that they're currently projected to receive over the next 2 years. Kotek says that while she supported Gainshare in 2007, she did not expect the program to be so expensive, and here is part of her testimony at a public hearing on April 9th.
We miscalculated the impact that this revenue sharing with particular counties would have on the rest of the state. Since the state's general fund is the prime funding source for education, human services, and public safety in all 36 counties, we didn't adequately take into account how this generosity would impact those counties and how it would take away from essential services from around the state, whether our schools, our programs for seniors, our community colleges, you name it, we fund those things. Our generosity has impacted the entire state.
The proposal barely passed the House Revenue Committee by a vote of 5-4, and now it will move to the state's Budget Committee.
Seattle Mayor Ed Murray has sent a resolution to the City Council that promises to help Somalis send money back to their home country. The Merchants Bank of California was the last bank that allowed Somalis living in the U.S. to send money back to Somalia. In February, the bank closed down all of its Somali-American accounts, citing concerns over transparency and the threat of terrorism. Nearly 50% of Somalia's economy depends on remittances, that is, money sent to Somalia by Somalis who live in other countries. Congressman Keith Ellison slammed the decision to stop remittances, saying that a decline in remittances will exacerbate the humanitarian crisis and erode the gains Somalia has made in recent years. Now, Seattle's mayor says he wants to fix the problem. Nearly 4,000 Somalis live in the city of Seattle, many of whom are new residents or refugees. The mayor's resolution requests that Seattle's various government departments explore new ways for these residents to continue to send remittances to their families back home in Somalia.
The Daimler Truck Company's Swan Island plant is being sued once again for racial discrimination, this time against an Arab American who was called Bin Laden by a supervisor. The Egyptian-born engineer is suing his former employer, Daimler Trucks North America, for $2 million. Hussein Fuad's lawsuit was filed this week in Multnomah County Circuit Court. In the filing, Fuad says that his supervisor often called him Bin Laden and suggested that he was a member of Al-Qaeda in front of co-workers or clients. This is just the latest in a series of lawsuits accusing the U.S. unit of the German company Daimler of racially hostile work conditions in Portland. In January, Daimler agreed to pay a record $2.4 million to settle complaints filed by six former workers who said they were the targets of racist or homophobic slurs, of Nazi graffiti, and of threats. One African-American employee reported that a co-worker waited for him in the parking lot with a noose. In February, four African-American current or former employees filed a $9.5 million lawsuit against Daimler, claiming that they were targeted with nooses, they were greeted with a Heil Hitler salute, or otherwise harassed on the job. The lawsuit filed this week states that Fuad was recognized for saving the company more than $1 million a year by suggesting that the company use aluminum wire instead of copper wire in some of its electrical connections. The suit claims that Fuad, who is 75 years old, received a positive performance review in his first year. But after a new supervisor arrived, his work rating rapidly deteriorated. His suit claims that his supervisor repeatedly asked him his age in front of coworkers, asked when he planned to retire. He mocked his accent and suggested he was sympathetic with Osama bin Laden. The lawsuits all have originated from employees based at Daimler's Western Star truck manufacturing plant right here on Swan Island.
Top congressional legislators reached a deal earlier today to introduce fast-track legislation of the Trans-Pacific Partnership to Congress. As the ranking Democrat on the finance panel, Oregon Senator Ron Wyden was crucial in reaching an agreement between Republicans and Democrats drafting the legislation. During deliberations, Senator Wyden was able to achieve concessions from Republicans granting that the completed trade deal must be made public for 60 days before the president signs it and allows for up to 4 months before Congress votes yes or no. Additionally, if the agreement, as negotiated by the United States Trade Representative, does not meet congressional standards on human rights, labor, and environmental regulation, then the Senate may, with a 60-vote majority, shut off the established fast-track trade legislation and open the deal to amendments by Congress. The Trans-Pacific Partnership would be the world's largest free trade agreement involving the United States, Canada, Mexico, Vietnam, Japan, and seven other Pacific Rim countries. It is heavily opposed by environmental groups, American labor unions such as the AFL-CIO, as well as human rights advocates. The Oregon chapter of the AFL-CIO has staged multiple protests calling for lawmakers to reject the trade deal. KBOO's Ethan Martin spoke earlier today with Tom Chamberlain, the president of the Oregon AFL-CIO.
My name is Tom Chamberlain, and I am the president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, which is a federation of 50 different unions with a membership of over 250,000.
Well, as I'm sure you probably know, Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon has reached an agreement with Senator Orrin Hatch in Washington, D.C. regarding introducing legislation that approves fast-track authority for the president. And there's some specifics that were reported in the New York Times earlier today, some specific concessions that Wyden was able to ensure. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with those, but I just maybe like to talk about them briefly. One of them is that the trade agreement will be made public 60 days before the president could sign it. And additionally, that Congress would have up to 4 months before voting yes or no. So they'd have some time to look at it and, you know, try and get their heads around it and then they would vote yes or no. And I was wondering what your thoughts are on that type of a time frame for Congress to comprehend and assess the trade agreement.
I think those are all good things to have, but the bottom line is that the core of this trade agreement isn't that much different than the trade agreement they tried to pass, fast track, that they tried to pass through the House last year, and it failed. Folks have to realize that there's never been a trade agreement with fast track that has failed to pass. And so this move to try to put lipstick on a pig, I don't think it's going to fool the public. It definitely doesn't fool us, and we're going to do everything we can to kill the trade agreement. And here's the other piece, Ethan, is that this isn't like when NAFTA was passed in the mid-90s under Clinton. We know what these trade agreements do. We know the impact on the environment. We know the impact on families. We know the impact on our economy. You know, since the passage of NAFTA, what you've seen in this country is a drop in real wages by $3,000 a year per worker. What we've seen are these trade agreements where our national sovereignty and our state sovereignty can be challenged by corporations through challenges to, like they did in Central America, challenge of minimum wage, or challenge to warnings on tobacco. Corporations under these trade agreements can challenge anything that erodes their profit.
Well, let's talk about the president's relationship to this trade agreement. So his support for the TPP, and specifically his vehement support for the fast track power, it's been really divisive for his Democratic support base, which includes labor groups and environmental groups and, you know, human rights groups, who all oppose the fast track authority and more broadly the TPP in general. How has Senator Wyden's support of the TPP and fast track affected his relationship with the Oregon AFL-CIO?
You know, it depends. Time will tell. You know, we work with Senator Wyden on a number of issues. Are we happy about this? No. It will have an impact on the relationship. That's something my affiliates are going to have to talk about. But we're not happy with this result.
Well, what plans does the AFL-CIO have on the national level to oppose the TPP? And then maybe you could specifically more talk about what the Oregon chapter has planned in the months to come to combat the TPP.
What you've seen in organized labor in total through the AFL-CIO is what I haven't seen in a very long time, and that's a united labor movement. And it's had an impact. The labor movement working with community groups, environmental groups, with trade coalitions, fair trade coalitions. You've had town hall meetings across this country. You're having a national day of action on Saturday where you'll have rallies from New York City to Tampa, from Portland, Maine to Portland, Oregon. And it won't stop. Or having workers going in and talking to their congressional delegations. And this is an issue, as I said before, that it doesn't matter what party you belong to, there is not the support of the American public or the appetite to support another trade agreement that costs us jobs, that undermines environmental standards. We've seen the result of that. Actions we've done here in Oregon, last week we had a town hall at the Hilton Hotel in downtown Portland where we had over 300 people attend. We've had town halls in Medford, Eugene, and Bend. And on the National Day of Action, you'll see marches in Portland, Oregon at 1 o'clock. You'll see marches in Coos Bay, Medford, Salem, Eugene, and Bend. And it's not just organized labor. This is a very broad coalition in opposition of fast track, and we just don't know enough about TPP to support it.
When is the National Day of Action?
That'll be Saturday.
Okay,
April 18th.
Could you kind of describe what is going to happen on Saturday here in Portland?
Saturday in Portland, we expect to have a very large rally at Terry Shrunk Park. with a March following, we'll have Labor Commissioner Bradavakian. We'll have Ramon Ramirez from Pocoon. We'll have Elizabeth Swaggart from the Fair Trade Coalition, and several other speakers. And then we're going to march. How we're going to turn this around is by taking to the streets, because corporations own the media. They can spin this any way they want. And we'll take it to the streets. We'll take it to the doorsteps. We're going to contact people. We're going to have town halls. And we're not going to let up on our congressional delegation until this thing is over. And at the end of the day, we're going to win.
That was Tom Chamberlain, the president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. And this is Ethan Martin with KBOO News.
An agency has purchased over $2 million worth of spying software from a shadowy Italian software company. The software is known as the Remote Control System. It can track mouse clicks, keystrokes, and it can also be used to take over a person's entire computer. According to an investigative piece by The Motherboard, the DEA bought the software from a company calling itself The Hacking Team. The company has allegedly sold it to agencies and countries around the world, including Saudi Arabia, Sudan, and Uzbekistan. In 2013, The Hacking Team released an ominous commercial for their products. Here's a very brief clip from that commercial.
You want to look through your target's eyes. You have to hack your target.
The DEA has declined to comment on the story. A spokesperson for the Hacking Team told Vice, "We don't identify our clients. I'm certainly not going to comment whether the DEA or anyone else has purchased Hacking Team software." The story comes on the heels of a Justice Department report that says DEA agents participated in sex parties funded by Colombian drug cartels.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth, where we'll take a look at this morning's protest against Nestle's proposed water bottling plant in the Gorge, followed by Rose City Native Radio on at 6. At 7, it's Ear to the Streets of Portland, featuring Sabrina Fulton, the mother of the slain Florida teenager Trayvon Martin, who spoke in Portland this past week. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny and clear with a high of 71 and a low of 46, and rain is unlikely. Today in history, in 1947, a ship carrying a large cargo of ammonium nitrate ignited in the harbor of Texas City, Texas, setting off a series of explosions that killed at least 581 people. It is the worst industrial disaster in U.S. history and resulted in the first ever class action lawsuit against the U.S. government. Also today, in 1963, Martin Luther King Jr. began writing his letter from a Birmingham jail in response to a coalition of white pastors who had criticized King for bringing his fight for justice out of the courts and into the streets. Our quote of the day is from that letter. "It is wrong to urge an individual to cease his effort to gain his basic constitutional rights because the quest may precipitate violence. Society must protect the robbed and punish the robber."
Well, looky here, it's 5:23 and time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
When you come across a corporate lobbying group claiming to be pushing, quote, responsible alternatives to such and such, you can rightly assume that it's really pushing something totally irresponsible, as well as malicious, self-serving, and even disgusting. That's the case of Arawak, the Association for Responsible Alternatives to Workers' Compensation. Mother Jones Magazine reports that this is a front group funded by hugely profitable retail chains and other corporate behemoths that want to weasel out of compensating employees who suffer injuries at work. By law, corporations in nearly every state must carry workers' comp insurance. But the Arawak lobbying combine is pressuring legislators to allow the giants to opt out of the state benefit plans and instead substitute their own highly restricted set of benefits. What a deal! But it's a raw deal for injured workers. In Texas, which already has this right-it-yourself loophole, more than half of the corporate plans, get this, pay nothing to the families of workers who are killed in job accidents. Similarly, under an Arawak-written opt-out provision that a Tennessee senator sponsored this year, employers would not have to cover artificial limbs, home care, or even funeral expenses of on-the-job accident victims. Also, the Tennessee bill lets a company simply walk away from maimed workers after just 3 years or after paying only $300,000 in expenses. Corporations always claim to value their employees, and this tells us exactly how little that value is. This is Jim Hightower saying, by the way, the CEO of Arawak also happens to be the head of risk management at the mingiest of workplaces, Walmart. And that's what this opt-out scam amounts to. Corporate profiteers hoping they can manage to escape paying for risking the lives of America's workforce.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
In the immediate wake of the 1973 military coup in Chile that overthrew democratically elected socialist president Salvador Allende and brought General Augusto Pinochet to power, thousands of citizens were arrested by the military, especially known dissidents and associates of the Allende government. Between 1973 and 1990, over 3,000 Chileans were killed or disappeared, and tens of thousands more were imprisoned and tortured for years. Justice for these crimes has been slow coming in Chile, where 260 people have been tried and sentenced for human rights violations since the transition back to democracy in the early 90s. Now, the alleged perpetrator of one of the most notorious murders that took place in the early days of the coup is being brought to court, not in Chile, but in the United States. KBOO's Sam Bowman has this report.
Victor Jara was one of the most prominent folk singers and theater directors in Chile during the 60s and early 70s. While he was known as a pioneering director of local, international, and experimental plays, he is most famous as a musician, one of the founders of the Nueva Canción Chilena, or New Chilean Song movement among folk musicians. Nueva Canción refocused popular music onto issues of social justice, human rights, and popular revolution, and played a prominent role in upheavals across the Spanish-speaking world. Jara was a cultural ambassador under the government of Salvador Allende, and had supported Allende's Unidad Popular Coalition by campaigning and playing free concerts. On September 11, 1973, the military overthrew the government of Salvador Allende, and the next day, Jara was arrested along with thousands of others and interned at Chile Stadium, now named Victor Jara Stadium. He was tortured for 4 days and eventually shot in the head by an officer, after which his body was riddled with bullets and thrown into the street of a slum in Santiago. Several of the soldiers involved have been arrested and tried in Chile, but the alleged leader of the squad that is responsible for Jara's death, former Lieutenant Pedro Barrientos Núñez, currently resides in Deltona, Florida. Barrientos was identified by other soldiers as the man who shot Jara in the head after overseeing his torture. The Chilean Supreme Court issued a request for his extradition in 2013, but the U.S. Department of Justice has not yet issued a response. Now, after a lengthy battle over the statute of limitations on human rights violations, the San Francisco-based Center for Justice and Accountability has brought a civil suit against Barrientos on behalf of Jara's wife and two daughters. A judge agreed to hear the case this week. I spoke with Amudena Bernabeu, CGA's international attorney, for more on the story.
Has the U.S. given any indication why it hasn't approved the order for extradition, or does it just usually take about this long?
My belief, and maybe I'm wishful thinking, by speaking a little bit my practice and experience in the past in other cases, and that if these lawsuits based on the civil action brought by the victims could help or at least add on to the potential willingness or work of the Department of Justice, because we're obviously going to have important evidence. We're going to have expert witness testimony. Obviously, some of the soldiers have agreed to testify. We're going to be bringing them and deposing them. So we're hoping that all of these court records that is going to be created as a consequence could serve or help in any way possible. Obviously, it's a public record that the Department of Justice could also rely on for purposes of extraditing Barrientos.
The judge agreed to hear the case, but threw out the charges of crimes against humanity. And is that going to affect the potential outcome of the case?
Well, no. The short answer, no, because under the Torture Victims Protection Act, which is the second law from 1992, that we are basing this lawsuit, torture and extrajudicial killing are included. So really the spectrum of both the violence inflicted in the person and body of Victor Jara, and obviously the final result of killing him, are going to be contemplated and well explained, and it is included in those claims. But it's a shame, to be honest, since the Kyovo decision, not to be fairly technical, it is absolutely backlash in U.S. jurisprudence and U.S. courts being able to talk about an international crime as important as crimes against humanity. Crimes against humanity, beyond just the pure torture of someone or the prejudicial killing, will show that this was done systematically against civilian, against the Chilean people. And that is very important for the family, very important for Chile as a country, to really talk about not just the individual pain and suffering, but to talk about what the Chilean people had to go through. They are still recovering from, you know, as many disappear remain, the destiny of many disappear remains unknown, and there's no way to know because the army refuses to talk. So calling it a crime against humanity is important for Chile, and that's what we were hoping to have. But, you know, after the Supreme Court decision, we have what we have.
And that brings up an interesting question for me, which is in Chile right now, the army is still essentially the same organization that it was during Pinochet's regime. Is that right?
Yes, and it is. It's not being cleaned up, for lack of a better word. I mean, it's one of the, there are many retired, obviously, given age, but they all have their pensions. They have not lost any benefits associated with their participation in the army, and they are not talking. And there's not being a way, I'm not saying that it's true that it's not being political will, certainly the administration of Michelle Bachelet would like to see that, but many conservative governments after another and many years, it's been really practically impossible to get the army to talk or to collaborate or to break in any way. It's this, what they call in Chile, the silent pact that the military have made. And we thought that when Pinochet died, things will change a little bit. So it's a very strong and disciplined army, and who they all participated to one degree or another, including conscripts. And so it is it has been really difficult to get anybody to talk.
Almudena Bernabeu, thank you very much for talking with us today.
What a pleasure. Thank you so much for the opportunity to tell you about this work. Thank you very much.
For KBU Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman, speaking with Almudena Bernabeu, the International Attorney and Transitional Justice Program Director at the U.S.-based Center for Justice and Accountability.
Today,
Oregon Food Bank and its advocates converged on the state legislature for Hunger Response Day. They're asking lawmakers to spare the Hunger Response Fund, the state's contribution to hunger-fighting efforts, and increase the funding to meet what they say is continued high demand for emergency food. KABU reporter Khalil has more in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
Oregon lawmakers may not be eating off paper plates this week, but they may be reading a few. Oregon Food Bank Network sites across the state have been collecting handwritten messages on paper plates from people who need food assistance to get through the month. They'll share them this week as they ask the legislators to keep and increase the Oregon Hunger Response Fund. Sarah Flynn with Oregon Food Bank says demand hasn't decreased, and yet there has been talk of reducing the Hunger Response Fund, as a state budget surplus could trigger the tax rebate known as the kicker, rather than funding social services.
The education budget was also completed earlier this session than in previous sessions. So there's less money left for our human services programs and the safety net, which have historically been underfunded.
The governor's budget recommends $2.7 million for the Hunger Response Fund over 2 years, the same as the previous 2 years. Flynn says for 4 years, Oregon Food Bank sites have given out more than 1 million emergency food boxes a year, so it's asking for just over $3 million. Hunger Response Fund dollars are used partly to buy food and partly divided among all food bank network sites for their own priorities, so that even the most rural areas can benefit. In Jackson County, Philip Yates at Access Medford says they use their money for Fresh Alliance, a program to collect produce and meat that stores would otherwise be throwing away.
And it's really prime quality food that we would not get otherwise. So that $45,000 helped to cover the cost of our personnel who drive around the county to pick the product up.
Yates points out that the more rural the county, the higher the transportation cost to stock its food banks. Flynn says about 250 people will attend the Legislative Action Day on Thursday. They'll deliver some paper plate messages to lawmakers from people in their districts. Others will be posted on a wall for display. Flynn reads one of the messages from a woman in Beaverton.
She said, "I cried when my son brought home his school lunch so that I would have dinner too. He didn't want me to be hungry because we didn't have enough for both of us to eat dinner."
For KBOO News, I'm Khalil.
An oil spill in the southern Mexican state of Tabasco last Sunday has left as many as 500,000 people without access to clean water for days on end. The spill was caused when trespassers deliberately slashed a pipeline owned by the national oil company, Pemex, presumably to steal the oil. Such oil thefts from pipelines were once so common that Pemex stopped shipping usable fuel through them years ago. This did not stop Sunday's thieves, however, and the resulting spill polluted two rivers and forced the shutdown of four water treatment plants in the state capital of Villahermosa. Two of the treatment plants reopened yesterday, but as of today, 100,000 people still do not have reliable access to water. The state government has been supplying locals with water from 13 tanker trucks, and Pemex employees have been dispatched to the rivers to scoop oil off the water using brooms that extend from the shore. But many of the affected residents are unimpressed with either effort. This incident comes only 2 weeks after a fire on a Pemex oil rig killed four workers, prompting many calls both inside and outside of Mexico for tighter regulations on the oil giant.
In the latest of a string of suspicious high-profile deaths in Ukraine, journalist and anti-Maidan activist Oles Buzina was gunned down by masked men shooting from a car today. The shooting took place in broad daylight in Kiev as Buzina was leaving his home, according to a Ukrainian Interior Ministry statement. The reporter had previously run unsuccessfully in a parliamentary election on the Russian bloc party ticket. Most recently, he worked as the editor-in-chief of Ukraine's Segodnia Daily, but resigned in March, citing censorship pressure. His killing followed the death on Wednesday of former Ukrainian parliament member Oleh Kalashnikov, who was found dead on the landing of his home with a gunshot wound. Kalashnikov had reported receiving threats of violence for his pro-Russian political views. An Interior Ministry spokesperson said both victims were witnesses in criminal cases involving pro-Russian activists accused of attacking Ukrainian pro-Maidan activists in 2014. The killings were just the latest in a spate of odd deaths among allies of Yanukovych, who was ousted from office last year. Since January, at least 8 former government officials have died under mysterious circumstances, with many of these deaths treated as suicides. The high-profile deaths have driven up tension between Moscow and Kiev, with Russian and Ukrainian officials trading accusations of responsibility for the deaths. Russian President Vladimir Putin has said that the murders are political, while Ukrainian President Viktor Poroshenko has vowed an investigation into murders that he says are playing into the hands of enemies of the Ukrainian government.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Thursday, April 16th, 2015. Israeli soldiers attack a protest near Ramallah and invade West Bank communities, leaving dozens injured civilians. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. On Thursday midday, 9 Palestinian civilians were injured when Israeli troops attacked a protest organized by Palestinian NGOs outside the Ofer Israeli military detention camp near the central West Bank city of Ramallah. According to medical sources, all 9 injured were hit by rubber-coated steel bullets fired by Israeli troops. Clashes erupted after the soldiers' attack and lasted for several hours, local media reported. The march was organized by Palestinian political prisoners support groups in protest of the ill treatment Palestinian political prisoners are facing in Israeli military detention facilities. Also near Ramallah, Israeli soldiers kidnapped 3 Palestinian children in Betunia town and took them to unknown destination after searching and ransacking their homes. Moreover, Israeli soldiers invaded on Thursday morning the Dehesh refugee camp in the southern West Bank city of Bethlehem and clashed with local youth. One Palestinian was injured and many others suffered the effects of tear gas inhalation, local sources reported. During the clashes, soldiers invaded the home of Jamal and Sami al-Ja'fari and occupied the rooftop of the family of Jihad al-Ja'fari, who was shot and killed there by Israeli army fire in February. In Jerusalem, a young Palestinian man was shot in the eye by an Israeli rubber-coated steel bullet, and 3 others were shot in the legs in Al-Isawiyya town, south of Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied East Jerusalem. The young man was on his way home when he was shot by Israeli soldiers who invaded the town and clashed with local youth. The young man was later moved to Hadassah Ein Karim Israeli Hospital in Jerusalem for treatment, while Israeli army is still claiming he was participating in the clashes. 3 young men were injured in their legs after the soldiers fired rubber-coated steel bullets at them. The soldiers also fired at Palestinian cars, shattering the front shield of 3 vehicles. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was a Thursday, April 16th, 2015, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Banoura.
The latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan. 250 Taliban fighters are reported to have attacked Afghan military outposts in the northeastern region of the country on Monday, killing at least 18 members of the Afghan Defense Forces. This is one of the first major attacks in what is known in Afghanistan as the summer fighting season. In the past 14 years of war, incidents tend to increase as snow melts in the country's mountain passes, allowing for more mobility by fighters. Meanwhile, the Afghan intelligence service has reported several successful arrests of shadow Taliban officials. The deputy provincial governor for the Taliban shadow government in the Balkh district was arrested in Kabul on Monday. And in a statement released on Wednesday, it was reported that the Taliban governor of the Ajristan district had also been arrested. The Chatham House, an international affairs think tank in London, has released a report detailing the significant threat of violence faced by international aid workers in Afghanistan, especially from improvised explosive devices known as IEDs. The region has a long history of casualties from landmines, but roadside IEDs are becoming an increasing threat to international aid workers, who, in some cases, are specifically targeted.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Alan Monticillo, Ethan Martin, Khalil, and Robert Onstadt. The producer is Sam Bowman. Special thanks to Paul Rowland. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Sarika Mehta.
I'm Robert Barncord. Coming up tomorrow morning, Friday, on KBOO at 7, it'll be Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting, the topic will be the Portland Renters Assembly, a gathering of people united by the burden of rent, which impacts renters, owners, and the houseless, as well as the overall ecosystem of our city. At 9, on Veterans Voice, Angie Hines interviews Marine Corps vet and war resistor Makaya Dutt, who deployed 4 times to Iraq, and Iraq War Army vet Ian Lavallee about the trouble with thanking veterans in their service and popular blanket statements such as, support the troops. At 10, it'll be Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. And at 10:15 here, Flashpoints Investigative News Radio with Dennis Bernstein. Thanks to all of you for listening to KBOO and to you KBOO members for your generous support. If you're not a current member yet, you can become one by simply going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth.